This season of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is proudly supported by Tanara Music Practice Platform.
Hi everyone, it's Tim here, and just before we get started, I've got a very exciting and important update to share with you today. In the next couple of weeks, you're going to notice a few changes occurring at timtopham.com, starting with the launch of our brand new name, topmusic.co. If you'd like to find out more about the new name and our rebranding process, please head to timtopham.com/topmusic, where I lay out all the details. Now, let's get on with the show.
Hi everyone, it's Tim here, and I wanted to let you know that tickets are now on sale for my very own Piano Teachers Conference being held here in Melbourne in January 2020. It's called Piano Pivot Live, and you can get your ticket and find out all the details now at pianopivotlive.com. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, reading my blog, and getting inspired by fresh lesson and business ideas, then this is the conference for you. This two-day experience will bring together your favorite speakers, unpacking topics from creative pedagogy to marketing, preschoolers to technology, and everything in between. You'll get all your morning and afternoon tea, snacks, and a full lunch included in your ticket price. And while I know you'll get inspired by our keynotes and get practical in our workshops, what I'm most excited by is the chance you'll have to work with our speakers and experts in small group mastermind and implementation sessions to help you ensure you get a return on your investment in 2020. So if you've ever thought about visiting Melbourne or Australia, then this is your chance. It will be the perfect start to a new year of teaching, hanging out with other teachers from around the world, getting inspired, planning your studio, and making real change for the year ahead. Buy your ticket now at pianopivotlive.com before they all sell out. Okay, let's get on with the show.
Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
Well, hello everyone, it's Tim Topham here again for another episode of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, and we are in the second half of Season 3, 2019. It's great to have you listening, and thank you so much for all the well wishes and lovely comments I received about the sound of my voice after the last episode. As you may remember if you missed it, the last episode, 175, was the first post surgery on my vocal cords. So do check into that episode. I'll give you a bit more detail about how it all went. But thank you very much for everything that I heard from you guys and the great wishes that you sent through. So in today's show, I'm having a fireside chat with one of America's well-known and most loved teachers. I'm going to introduce you to him in a second, but if you've been to an NCKP conference or had anything to do with the Francis Clark Center, this is a name that you will know and love. And after today's show, probably know and love even more. It's a great interview, and I can't wait to introduce you to my guest today. But just before that, I did want to let you know about something that I'm very excited about. In relation to Piano Pivot Live, I am launching a scholarship program for the event. So what this scholarship program is for teachers, young teachers really new to the profession, have been teaching for 2 years or less. Perhaps they're not even really formally teaching, they're just students at this stage. What I really want to do is encourage your people that you know. So if you're listening to this and you've got students in your studio, perhaps they're 18, 19, 20, they've been with you for 10 years and you can see they're really interested in piano teaching as a potential career or at least something to do while they're studying, then these are the kinds of people that I would love you to refer to the scholarship program. The scholarship winners will get a 50% discount on registration to the conference. And so that's, half price, which will enable, I hope, those who are just starting their studios and perhaps haven't got that many students or they're still studying and so income is a bit tight, to be able to attend a conference that is literally going to change the way they approach their business and set themselves up for an incredible career as a music educator. So the guidelines around this are all online. You can head to pianopivotlive.com/scholarship. And this is for applicants who are new teachers with less than 2 years experience and no formal teaching qualifications. They need to be 18 years or older. And you'll need to submit your application via the nomination form at pianopivotlive.com/scholarship. So all the details are there about how it's being awarded and what you need to do. But I'm really excited about this because one thing I'm incredibly passionate about is trying to support the growth and development of our next generation of teachers. And so if this can help even a few young, fresh, excited, motivated, talented teachers or potential teachers to come along to this conference, then this will have had a great effect. So go and check it out, pianopivotlive.com/scholarship. And please, if you're a piano teacher listening, have a think about any students or ex-students of yours who could be a good applicant for this program. And indeed, if you're in an institution of some sort, please do share this far and wide, because we would love to have a nice, strong contingent of young new teachers at the conference. Okay, let's get on with today's interview. As usual, our full show notes, links, and transcript are at timtopham.com/episode176. And remember, as I said last week, if you haven't checked out our show notes recently, then you're going to get a little bit blown away. So go to that link, timtopham.com/episode176, and you'll be able to actually click through and click on any questions that I ask or discussion topics that are all listed there, and it will actually jump to the right place in the interview where we're talking about that very thing. It's very, very cool. Go and check it out. My guest today is known among piano teachers throughout the USA for his teaching, lecturing, performing, and publishing. Currently, he maintains a private studio in the Philadelphia area and teaches at the New School for Music Study in Princeton. He is the former board president of the Francis Clark Center for Keyboard Pedagogy and is on the executive planning committee of the National Conference on Keyboard Pedagogy, NCKP. In 2007, the online journal Piano Pedagogy Forum published tributes to him honoring his contribution to piano teaching in America. Also in 2007, he was named Fellow of the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto. He was honored in 2009 with MTNA's highest honor, the MTNA Achievement Award, and was selected in 2013 by the National Conference on Keyboard Pedagogy for its Lifetime Achievement Award. Welcome to the show, Marvin Blickenstaff.
It's my pleasure, I assure you.
Well, look, I've wanted to have you on the show for some time now. I think we connected way back at my first NCKP, probably 2015 or thereabouts. But it's so busy at those conferences. We're just kind of passing. It's like, hey, Marvin, hey, Tim.
So
it's great to be able to sit down with you for 30, 40 minutes and unpack some of your life and the ideas and ways of teaching that you love sharing with teachers. So I'm glad we could make it work.
Well, this is my pleasure.
So for those teachers who perhaps aren't so familiar with you, can you tell us a little bit about what you do today and where you're based and what kind of teaching you do?
Yeah. Well, I'm a piano teacher.
And you're on the right podcast then.
Yeah. I teach every day but Sunday. I split my time between my home studio and the New School for Music Study, which is about an hour and 15 minutes away from where I live. I live outside of Philadelphia in the state of Pennsylvania. The New School for Music Study is in the state of New Jersey in the town of Princeton, where there's a famous university. In both places, I have some adults. My main students are pre-college students, but with all ages. I feel quite comfortable after having taught for so many years of teaching at all levels. So I love to start children. I feel most comfortable with children who are like 6 and 7 years old. I don't deal with preschool children. That's not one of my areas of experience or expertise. But after that, I love my junior high school kids and the high school kids who are getting ready for college. And then in both places, I have a number of adult students. And I teach every day except Sunday.
Yeah, that's busy. You don't do a full day Saturday as well, do you?
I have a number of students. I start Saturday about 10 o'clock in the morning and don't finish until mid-afternoon.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's busy. I remember when I used to teach on Saturdays, I was really happy, as was my partner, that I stopped doing that.
Yeah.
It's hard work. How many private students do you have in your home, Marvin?
Over a dozen. It's about 12 or 14 students.
Wonderful. And you mentioned the New School for Music. That's part of the Francis Clark organization, right? Which, and we
absolutely
mentioned the KP conference.
Yeah.
So how long have you been associated with them?
21 years.
Wow.
21 years. My wife and I moved to the East Coast from Indiana, which is sort of in the middle of the United States. We moved to the East Coast 21 years ago. And before we moved, I got a phone call from Louise Goss, who said, we hear you're moving east. Can you come teach for us? And I was looking for work, and I've been here ever since.
Amazing.
It has been one of the most enjoyable collaborations in my whole teaching life. Our faculty here is very high quality. They're wonderful people. We get along fabulously, and we learn from one another all the time. I think that's one of the joys of teaching in a school where you have colleagues. One of the problems with independent teachers is that they are so isolated, and they don't have the stimulation of their colleagues. And I look forward to every Tuesday and Wednesday when I come to the New School and get to be with my colleagues and share ideas. It's great.
It's one of the reasons that I've really enjoyed creating online resources, the podcast, to enable that connection when people are driving in their cars to their next student.
Exactly.
Or working from home. Yeah, I think it's really important, that connection. I've worked in school environments for a lot of my career, and so I know exactly that the camaraderie, but also the development and professional development that comes from that.
Exactly.
So can you give us a glimpse into a week in the life of...
I'm not sure you want to know,
but you do because you do present at different events and things like that as well. So, is there ever a normal week?
I would say that most of my weeks are quasi normal. There's that routine of teaching at home on Mondays, coming to the New School on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, teaching at home on Thursdays and Fridays and Saturdays, having Sunday off.
Right.
So that's kind of a normal week.
Yeah.
But I do travel quite a bit. I'm frequently invited to speak to piano teachers groups or at conventions and conferences. That adds a lot of color and variety to my schedule, and that's fun. I enjoy meeting people and getting out of town. What that does is it burdens many times my schedule because I need to make up lessons when I'm out of town and that kind of thing. But my life, I could hardly wish for a better life, actually. I feel like I'm very blessed. I enjoy very much working with children. I'm thrilled to be in the music business and meeting wonderful people and collaborating with other wonderful people. I'm just one lucky guy.
That's so nice to hear. I feel very much the same with the connections that I'm able to make and things like that. So, it's lovely to hear that. I know that people who know of you would be fascinated to know a bit about your background as a boy learning piano. Can you tell us when you started, who you learned with, and what your lessons were like?
It's a kind of a very varied and modeled background. I have two older brothers, and they studied piano. They learned when they were youngsters. My mother played piano a little bit, and she thought it would be a great idea for all of us to learn to play the piano. And I could not wait until I was my mother allowed me to take piano lessons. I wanted to do the same thing that my brothers were doing. I remember one funny thing about my first piano teacher. My brothers were taking from the same teacher. And so we would go together and take lessons from Mrs. Hostetler. Well, Mrs. Hostetler had a tree outside her house that was just perfect for climbing. The branches were just exactly right. And so while one of the brothers was taking piano lessons, The other two brothers would go out and climb the trees in your yard.
Life was simpler in those days, wasn't it?
I don't remember much about the lessons, but I'll never forget that tree. I then switched to a couple other lessons, a couple other teachers. But when I was in the seventh grade, something happened in my life that really turned my life completely around. When I was in the seventh grade, I announced to my mother one day that I was bored with piano lessons and I thought it was time for me to quit. And she said, "Oh, I'm not sure I'm willing to buy into that." And she said, "You're bored?" I said, "Yeah." She thought a little bit and she said, "I think I know how I can fix that." And she said, "I'll call Fern." Fern. It happened that the very best piano teacher in the whole state of Idaho, where I grew up, not all, just our hometown, but the whole area, she was the best teacher. And when Mother said, "I'll call Fern," that sent a little bit of shiver up and down your spine, because that meant real commitment.
Right.
So anyway, the contact was made. Fern had room for me in her studio. And after two or three lessons, I really would have signed a contract with God Almighty that I was going to be a pianist. Wow. She was so exciting. The demands were high, but she made the music seem like such a big deal that I thought there's nothing more wonderful than playing the piano and studying with Fern.
Gosh, isn't that the power of a teacher demonstrated?
Isn't that a wonderful testimony to the power of a teacher? So I say, you know, there have been two or three women in my life, like my mother and my wife and Fern, who really were absolutely pivotal in my life.
Yeah.
Fern changed my life. A hometown piano teacher changed my life. And after those first couple lessons, I never had question whatsoever that I was going to stay in music and in piano.
Wow, it's extraordinary.
My parents,
particularly for a kid who was going to quit.
Yeah, interestingly enough, my parents were not so convinced that they were going to let me stay in piano. But I was doing well, and one time I won a big competition, a tri-state competition, in the Pacific Northwest, and came home, and the next morning, my dad looked across the breakfast table at my mother and he said, "Mother, if Marvin wants to major in music in college, I think we'll let him." And so I had the vote of confidence of my parents, and it's just been wonderful ever since.
Well, it would have been pretty ironic for them to turn around after all that success and go, "No, you're not allowed to do it. Yeah. So your teacher, Fern, now spelt F-E-R-N, is that right?
F-E-R-N, that's right.
That was her first name?
That was her first name.
Yeah, wow.
There are a number of American women who have the first name of Fern.
Right. Yeah. It's quite unusual for me to hear that.
Yeah.
I relate, you know, I've got a similar story of my childhood teacher. So I've got a picture on my wall to remind me.
Yeah.
Changed the course of my life as well. It was a very roundabout course, but I eventually came back to it. And it's amazing the impact that we can have as teachers. And do you keep this in mind, Marvin, when you're teaching and you're particularly taking on a new student? Are you thinking about Fern and what she did for you and whether you could do that for your students?
It may be way in the back of my mind, but I will tell you that my study at home is lined with thank you notes and Christmas cards and things that my students write to me. And they're grateful for our relationship and for what they've learned. Yeah. Mm. I have lots of reinforcement that the impact that I've had on my students' life is somewhat significant. Whether anybody would say that, like I would say that Fern changed my life, I don't think anybody would say that Marvin changed their lives. But anyway, we have a good relationship.
I can see the love of music comes through when I watch things like your Francis Clark Center webinars.
Yeah.
And I've seen lots of people teachers, particularly about beginners. There's something about your approach. Yeah, it's so friendly and warm and caring and open and genuine. And all you put across is this love of wanting to share what you know. I just wonder whether you were like this at the start when you started teaching, or whether this has really grown over time as you've become more experienced.
I would reflect that I'm not sure that any of us know really how our personalities were formed. I had wonderful parents, and my parents constantly told their three sons that life was not for what you get for yourself, it's for what you give to others. And I can't imagine a better basis of growing up in a family where we were taught that the meaning of life is to give to other people. And I think, I mean, that's just such a wonderful springboard for being an effective teacher. And when I'm working with a student, unconsciously, I think I'm trying constantly to give the best I have to that student, to help that student grow, give that student the meaning of beautiful music, have them make the music. So anyway, I think it goes really back to what my parents taught me as one of life's basic values.
Mm. So there you are with Fern. You've started. She's completely changed your world. You are now piano from the age of 12 or 13. Yeah. Take us through high school and then your decision. I assume you went and studied piano performance at university.
That's right. That's right. I went to Oberlin, which is a liberal arts college, but it's also a conservatory. Had a wonderful teacher who played fabulously. We went through a lot of repertoire. I won some of the competitions and awards, played the Beethoven Emperor Concerto with the orchestra when I was a senior. The faculty voted on who gets to play with the orchestra, and I won that, you know. And then I've had some study time in Europe, came back, did a graduate degree at the University of Indiana, had a fabulous Hungarian teacher. There's something about Hungarian pedagogy that is unique in the world, I think.
It sounds scary to me when you say Hungarian.
Yeah, well, I've known a couple of Hungarian teachers, and I cannot, both of the Hungarian professors that I've had literally knew the entire piano repertoire. They could sit down and play all 600 Scarlatti sonatas if you wanted
them. No way.
Yeah, it's just incredible. And this one teacher that I had at Indiana University, a Hungarian professor, he could even tell you which side of the page a certain passage was in a Beethoven sonata.
No. He had
photographic memory. Anyway. No, these guys were wonderful, and they were certainly inspiring.
Mm.
But then, actually, I've studied with a couple of Hungarian teachers, and it is really uncanny how they have covered the repertoire. You know, most of us feel comfortable if we can play a handful of Beethoven sonatas and some Mozart and a concerto or two. These guys know it all. It's amazing.
Is that because when they're really young, they plow through the repertoire and it's just all in their fingers before the age of 18 and it just stays there? Yeah.
I think there's a lot of that they really accumulate an awful lot of repertoire. I think also it has to do with their theory training and their ear training. They'll look at a Mozart sonata and they say, "Oh, well, yes, I know how this is put together." Yeah, the cadence patterns, you know, and the figurations and things, and they could learn a sonata overnight if they had to.
I'm always amazed when I see a masterclass with a real master who
gets
the piano and not only give advice to someone playing all the Chopin etudes, but can play them without any music.
Exactly.
Piano. I don't know how it's amazing. Yeah.
Well, that is inspiring, and it actually allows you to know the almost limitless capability that we have with our mind and with our fingers. Yeah, some people have accomplished amazing things.
Yep, I'm just happy to get through one of those.
Exactly, we're on the same page.
Yeah, right. Good. I assume you're not performing these days.
Well, I do. I try to practice every day. We have at the new school, we have faculty recitals, and I try to play on all those faculty recitals. I'm coming up in the spring for a very special birthday. I'll not divulge my age, but anyway, I'm coming up this spring for a birthday, and I'm planning to play a recital as sort of celebration of my birthday.
Wonderful.
A solo recital.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so if you have the choice to practice and perform any music, what's your go-to composers or works?
Schubert and Chopin.
Right.
I just think Schubert wrote some of the most beautiful music. I just can't get over sometimes what Schubert does with his harmonies. Mm. There was a special sensitivity that he had. And I often tell my students, Schubert can, with a half step, he can change your life. Moving a half step in a chord, and you think, I'm a different person because I've heard that modulation or something.
And of course, the lyricism is...
It's just incredible. Yeah.
And what about Chopin? What are your go-to works?
Well, I've played quite a bit. I've played one of the sonatas quite a bit. I practice every day on about five or six of the etudes. Mm-hmm. The nocturnes are wonderful. On this recital that I'm thinking about, I'm going to do the Berceuse and the F minor fantasy.
I've got it up there. I love F minor fantasy. Yeah. One of my all-time favorite works.
Yeah, exactly. So, I've played all 24 of the Chopin preludes in recitals. It's just a never-ending feast of pianism and wonderful sound.
Yeah, would Schubert or Chopin be your desert island book to take?
I think probably Chopin because of the diversity.
I'm super delighted that Tanara is supporting this season of the podcast and wanted to take a minute to tell you what they offer. Tanara creates an inspiring community for music teachers and students throughout each week. We know that apps don't teach quality music. Teachers do, and Tanara can make your teaching even more engaging. Help your students discover the difference effective practice can make. Tanara is available on mobile, tablet, and desktop. So head to tanara.com, that's TONARA.com, and sign up for a 30-day free trial, or head to your respective mobile store on your device and download the app. Let Tanara create happiness in your studio today. So you've gone to university, you've had lots of success with your performing, winning competitions, you've had a lot of different teachers and experiences. When did you decide, or what was the catalyst for you going, I think I want to teach piano now?
Part of it was necessity. In America, at least, you go to graduate school and you get your degrees and stuff, but there's not a concert career awaiting for you.
Everywhere in the world, I think.
You have to win something like the Van Cliveren competition. I did have the great good fortune. I tell you, my life has been blessed. I am such a lucky man. I went through graduate school knowing that I had a job waiting for me at a college out in the middle of Kansas. It's very interesting. I had personal connections there. The president called me aside and said, we don't expect you to come to our college for your undergraduate work, but I want you to know that there's a job waiting for you when you have finished your study. Now, how many people get to say that? So I went through graduate school knowing that I had a job waiting for me. And so there was teach. The interesting thing about your question, Tim, is that from the very beginning, I have had a foot in piano pedagogy as well as teaching on a more advanced college level. Every place I've gone, they said, oh, well, now you're going to teach the piano pedagogy course. And so that happened to me at that college. It happened when I went to the University of North Carolina. It happened when I went to a college in Indiana. It was pedagogy and performance all the way.
Right.
That's been a real blessing because I've learned so much about how to teach when I was teaching pedagogy courses and observing students do their teaching. Mm. Now, as I say, my life has been very blessed with these opportunities. Mm. I thought, oh, this is a real burden that I have to teach piano pedagogy. And it turned out to be a blessing.
How interesting. Yes, because as a performer, you just want to perform and perform.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But you realize that, we need to make some money, so I better teach. But you actually found that it was a true calling, not just teaching, but also teaching teachers or the next generation of teachers?
Yeah, that's interesting. That also grew over time. I started, you may not be interested in this part of my life, but let me say this.
I love the expression, and no one else can see the expressions on your face, but they are so animated.
Anyway, so I was teaching in Kansas for several years, and then I thought, I really need to get some more studying, and I've never studied in New York City. And so I packed my bags and went to New York City. Some friends in New York had suggested a private teacher that I should investigate studying with. And so I contacted him, and he said, yes, you can come, et cetera, et cetera. But I quickly ran out of money. New York City is a very expensive. You can run out of money pretty quickly in New York City. And so through some connections, I found a job at the Carl Fisher Publishing Company. Carl Fisher was one of the old American music publishers. And so I worked there in their orchestral rental library for a while. And then they found out that I could play the piano. And they said, nobody's been doing workshops for Carl Fisher for a long time. We'd like to send you around the country and have you do workshops on Carl Fisher publications. Mm. You go through the library, pick out what you want to talk about, and we'll send you out. I can't tell you what a privilege that was and how that launched my whole career as a workshop presenter. Mm. They sent me all over the country to some of the main music stores. And so I got to know teachers in the different areas. I got to learn a little bit about the music business and several places where I was, they would say, well, would you like to play a recital? And so I'd play a recital on the evening after I'd given a workshop and stuff. It was just great. So I really had a wonderful opportunity to get my workshopping career started through giving these workshops for the Carl Fisher Publishing Company.
Mm, I've heard of Carl Fisher, but I think it's been absorbed by one of the other ones now. Is that right?
To a certain extent, but no, I think they just have a lesser of the market share.
Right. Okay.
But they're still an independent company. Yeah.
Well, I think it would be a mistake not to talk a little bit about piano teaching and tips and techniques and things like that.
Yeah.
So, what do you see as you go around giving a workshop? What do you see as some of the mistakes that you feel teachers are making with their teaching, particularly of beginners?
I think I think there are a couple of things. I think that in general, one could say that a lot of teachers of beginners underestimate the ability of young students to make beautiful music, to shape a sound. And teachers are quite satisfied if a child can put a finger on a right note and count a certain number of beats and then go to the next note. And so they work with the mechanics, but they don't work with the music. Mm. I find it very important right from the very beginning to talk about dynamics, to talk about shape. In the early months, almost weeks, I tell my beginning students, you know, there's a rule that you can use for the rest of your life that the last note of a phrase is the quietest. And you wouldn't believe how that helps students shape a phrase. Mm. They see the phrase mark, they see the last syllable of a word in the lyrics, you know, and they say, oh, Mr. Blickenstaff says that's the quietest note. And it's just almost like magic. But we don't, I think teachers with beginners do not work enough on dynamics and shaping of the sound. Mm. Another thing that I think we don't do, we sort of undersell our students' ability to listen sensitively to the sound. I play a little game with my students where they'll play a note and they have to hold it for three counts and listen very carefully to the diminuendo of that note and then match that with an adjacent note. So play C, D, and we match sounds.
Oh, match where it, the sound has decayed to.
When exactly. You
play an episode, right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And there are a lot of advanced pianists that don't listen very carefully to the decay of a sound so that they can match it with the next tone. Mm. But you can get students with that right away. Another thing I do with my students is to try to develop their ear with matching of the sounds. But we also play a little game where they are required to sing, "This is the sound of middle C." Yeah. And they put their hand to their throat and they sing middle C. So they develop kind of a perfect pitch for middle C.
How does that go? Does it it does stick?
Oh yeah, No, they can get that. I do something with my students that is it's really hokey and has no
scientific basis
in reality. Yeah, but they put their hand up to their throat. And they feel where middle C lives in their throat.
Ah.
This is the sound of middle C, you know. And so every time they sing middle C, they put their hand up in their throat and find where middle C lives.
That's a nice little exercise, a little challenge. Yeah. How long do you find it takes students to be able to reliably recite and get that note right?
2 weeks.
Wow, there you go. I'm going to test a couple of my students on this one.
Yeah. And then I would also say, you asked me about sort of mistakes that teachers make with their beginning students. I feel very strongly that there's only about one chance that you have to teach a student how to read well. Or read properly, guiding the eye. Francis Clark, whom you have mentioned earlier in this interview, Francis Clark, I think, was the first person that seriously sat back and say, why don't students read music the way we read a magazine or a newspaper? We read fluently, and students read with stuttering eye movement. She said, when you read a magazine or a newspaper, you don't look at individual letters. You don't look at individual syllables. You don't even look at individual words. You see phrases.
Mm.
And she said, here we're teaching beginning students to name a note and find that note on the keyboard and play that note. And then the eye goes over, name the next note, find that note, and play that on the keyboard. She said, That is such a slow way to read a musical phrase. A musical phrase has a shape to the pitches. And so Frances Clark sat back and said, well, now what are we going to do about this? And she wiped the slate clean. And she said, first of all, we don't need clef signs. We don't even need rhythmic values. Basically, what we need to do is show the eye how you go from a line to a line, or a space to a space, or a line to a space. And let's call line to line skips, and line to space steps, and see and read by the shape of the musical pitches, you know.
Mm.
It really revolutionized reading. I'm so proud of my little kids because they read so well, and it's simply because we start out intervallically reading, you know.
Mm.
I get them down on the floor and we make skips with steps, you know, with big note heads on cardboard, poster board staffs. And you don't need a grand staff. All you need is a couple lines and a few spaces, and move your notes around. And they're learning about skips and steps. And what they're doing is seeing shapes. And they can go to the keyboard and play those shapes on the keyboard. Anyway. Mm,
yeah, it's great. And intervallic reading has now become quite commonplace.
Well,
it's beginning to anyway, more people are realizing that, learning and reciting those mnemonics just is not helpful. It sounds like your own lessons were quite traditional and focused on repertoire and reading and things. Correct me if I'm wrong.
They are indeed.
Yeah. They were, yep. But when I see you in action in a workshop and teaching, you are quite flexible and I would say quite creative with your first lessons and the things you do with children at the start. And you're bouncing around the keyboard and you're having lots of fun and there are games and things. Do you tend to do those kind of activities alongside reading quite early, or do you tend to leave reading a little bit later?
No, I would say basically we get started with reading almost from the beginning. Mm-hmm. In the very beginning, I have one main goal about the first lesson that I teach a student, and that is that the student leaves the lesson being able to play a couple of pieces. Mm-hmm. Now, those are obviously rote pieces because we're not reading it. Mm. And so part of that lesson is devoted to teaching the student some rote pieces, because I want the student to leave that first lesson saying, I can play the piano. And there's such positive benefit from that. They come back all excited. But then relatively early in this whole curriculum, we get down on the floor and we start making line and space notes and then work with intervals. And that leads into the reading. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. Like that getting off the bench onto the floor.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Big movements.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
What about specifically on technique? What is a couple of the most important things that you impart to children first learning to move at the piano?
Okay.
And play notes.
Yeah. Sitting position. I have a little warm-up drill for my students that they are to touch their ears with their shoulders. Five times. Yeah. Once again. And then And what that is supposed to do is to give the child a sense of how the torso feels. How when you sit at the piano, your shoulders are relaxed and loose. Another thing that we do with beginning technique, I have the students actually put their hand out flat and slowly draw the hand in so that all of the fingers are touching, and mm-hmm. and we have what we call a cluster. There's no space between the fingers, but you can see all of the fingernails lined up in a row, and the thumb is curved into the side of the hand. Mm-hmm. Now, that actually is a shape of the hand, and I believe very strongly that in the very first lesson, the student should experience good hand shape. Mm. And that really does it. The hand is actually stronger than the sum of its parts. This is a really reliable hand feeling and shape. Mm. And so they feel strong about that. So instead of starting out playing individual fingers, we establish that cluster position. And we move the cluster around. It's very interesting that the hand with the cluster shape is so reliable that the rest of the body is feels loose and relaxed.
Mm.
Kind of interesting that in beginning piano technique, you have a combination of firmness and relaxation in your arm and your hand, but most students get it backwards. A lot of children have sort of spaghetti fingers, and in order to compensate that, their arm will be tight.
Mm.
And it's very important, I think, you get the firmness in the cluster, and then the arm is naturally relaxed. Mm. Those are a few. The other thing, Tim, about the cluster is that you have a model for the rest of your life about fingers playing on the tip and the curvature. And I have my students look inside their hand with the cluster. You see curves inside. You see curves outside. You see how your fifth finger is playing right on the tip of the finger. The thumb is curved in. And that's something that does not need to change for the rest of your piano life.
Mm.
It's great.
Yeah, it's good. Yep. And I think I've read somewhere about Frances Clark and that approach. I think this comes from her originally. Is that right?
No, yes. It comes from me.
I don't. Sorry.
I could go into a long story about that, but it comes from me.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Okay. And the other thing, the other trick is when the fingers play independently, having the behind the joint. Do you do that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I call that a reinforced fingertip, that you push the thumb behind that last nail joint.
Mm.
Yeah. And when I start students playing their first rote pieces, we use a reinforced third finger for that. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. And obviously all non-legato to start.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Yeah. 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 Oh, that's but great.
Let me talk a little bit about legato. Do you mind if I go on with this?
Yeah.
Legato is difficult for beginning students because they want to kind of push each individual note with them. So one of the things that I do very early in a student's instruction is that we learn how to rock the hand. And the older I get, the more important I think it is for us to teach rotations to our students, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, in my student's second or third lesson, we learn a little tune that says, rock the hand to play the skips. And we can do that between 1 and 3, or we do 2 and 4. Rock the hand to play the skips.
You're making sure the hand's moving like this.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Rock the hand to, and we do it up in the air, just like you were doing. Rock the hand to play the skips, okay? It's very interesting that a legato naturally develops when you rock your hand, because you're taking the tone from one fingertip to go to the next fingertip. Rock the hand to play the skips. It's very interesting. And then after the students really get good with that, that takes 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. and then we add another little part that goes, rock the hand to play the skips. Fingers play the steps.
Right, 1, 2, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, that's right.
You're starting to mix up the movements.
That's
yeah.
right. And so they get used to the idea that when you have intervals that are bigger than a second, like a third or a fourth or a fifth, the hand is responsible for doing that. You tip the hand, you know. And then when you have step motion, your fingers do that.
Mm.
If you were to step into my studio, and it doesn't matter whether it's a little girl who's only had a couple years lesson, or whether it's one of my high school students, every one of my students starts their lessons with some kind of stretching activity. That's to get the blood flowing in your hand. And then the next thing they do is play a little exercise and go 5-1-4-1-3-1-2-1-3-1-4-1-5-1. And those are rotation exercises.
Mm.
I don't know why it has taken me so long to realize that basic rotation is one of the primary goals of elementary technique. Mark that down.
That's great.
They'll put that on my tombstone. He believed in rotations.
They're not going to be able to fit everything on your tombstone, Marvin. It's too much. I'm conscious of the time, and although I think we could talk for some time, I do find it fascinating. And although I love doing creative and improvisationary and popular music things with my students, I value strongly the importance of a classical tradition and getting technique right. So I do enjoy talking about it with people, because there are so many different ideas out there. But I think as I'm getting older, I'm starting to refine, as you've done, my approach and the things that I do with my beginners that I'm really happy with and that I see are working.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful to talk with you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. And I'm just only sad that it's going to be another couple of years before we get to meet in person at the next conference.
Great. Maybe well, you can come to MTNA.
Actually, I will be at MTNA. There we go. We can catch up there.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Thank you so much, Marvin. It's been an absolute pleasure.
A pleasure for me. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed today's chat with Marvin Blickenstaff. I must say I feel so much closer to him, and I'm truly looking forward to being able to connect with him at another conference in the future. He's just such a standout human, standout teacher. And if you haven't had a chance to have a look at some of his webinars,
that he produces for the Francis Clark Center, then definitely jump on their website. We'll put a link in our show notes to it. Just seeing him in action, teaching, particularly teaching beginner methods and things like that, is just fantastic. It will really warm your heart, and I highly recommend you check those out. Next week on the podcast, we have a very special guest from New Zealand who is going to be talking all about technique. She's actually head of piano at Auckland University, and she was a guest on my recent webinar on technique that we held at the very end of October. It was one of the busiest webinars I've ever done. We had almost 2,000 teachers registered, and I tell you what, if there was one of our panel who got more questions than anyone else and whose ideas just in a one-hour webinar were already resonating with teachers around the world, it was the guest who I've got coming on to the show next week. And we're going to unpack a new book that she's created. It's a completely online and on-device ebook with videos, with examples. It's extraordinary what she's put together. It's called Fit for Piano, Fit Number 4 Piano, and we'll unpack it in the next episode. I'm Tim Topham, and this is the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Now, just before you go, if you enjoyed today's show, I'd love for you to check out my Inner Circle piano teaching community. It's the go-to resource for piano teachers looking to continue their professional development, connect with other teachers and experts from around the world, and to access hundreds of world-class training resources, including our academy courses, lesson plans, teaching videos, technology help, and much more. Whether you're just starting out or have been working hard to build your studio for a while, the Inner Circle community will give you the skills, support, and confidence you need to grow the studio of your dreams. Whether that's about teaching a small number of students one-on-one in your home, or hiring a commercial space, employing other teachers, and building an entire music teaching empire. With courses on both the teaching and business side of running your studio, live coaching, and our thriving community forums, you can get quick answers to questions, set yourself challenges, get feedback on your ideas, and feel confident teaching in new and exciting ways. For more information on how to join us inside the Inner Circle today, head over to timtopham.com/community, and we'll see you on the inside.
We'll conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon PIANOPODCAST for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.